We are speaking with Mike Rupert. He worked for the Los Angeles Police Department. He produces a publication, From the Wilderness, and he has just come out with a new book, Crossing the Rubicon, The Decline of the American Empire in the End of the Age of Oil. Mike, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
So if we could begin with a little history, what was it that motivated you back to joining the police department, the LA Police Department?
Well, I had always had an interest in law enforcement, and of course I graduated from high school at the peak of the Vietnam War. Didn't really want to go to fight and serve in a war that I believe was unjust at the time, but did have, as many young men do, a desire to prove myself, if you will, and really believe that I could make a difference by making the streets of my country and my city, Los Angeles, safer by being a policeman. I was just really enamored of the work, and I started interning for LAPD in my freshman year at UCLA. And what happened was that when a background check was run on me, they found out that both of my parents had long and deep connections to the intelligence community with lots of clearances. My mother had been a cryptanalyst for the Secretary of State, Cordell Hull. My dad had worked in the Air Force and on top secret projects for the CIA with an aerospace firm, Martin Marietta. And I had a Q clearance simply because I was raised in the same house as my father and my mother because of the material they had handled. So I was quickly identified and groomed by the Office of the Chief of Police at LAPD. Having many CIA relatives, I also came to the attention of the CIA as I was going through college and constantly on the dean's list and groomed for that. So the CIA wanted me as well. That led to two attempts to recruit me, one of which took place in my senior year at UCLA. And the CIA wanted me to become a case officer and come back through the LA Police Academy and work undercover, which was illegal at the time. It's not since the Patriot Act. The second attempt, I refused the first, and the second attempt was after I had become a police officer, which was a covert or clandestine recruitment, and that led me to discover ultimately in 1977-78 that the CIA was bringing large quantities of drugs into the country, and I became a whistleblower on that, which effectively ended my career. I was being shot at and threatened. I asked the chief of police for help, and the chief said he was too busy, and if I was still alive, maybe he would find time to talk to me, and that's when I resigned and effectively went public back in 1979.
So prior to those discoveries, did you have a positive viewpoint of our intelligence agencies?
Well, as most Americans did at that time, yes. I had a lot of skepticism about the CIA, which is why I never had any interest in working for them. We'd had a lot of revelations in the late 60s and early 70s about CIA dirty deeds, and I just wanted to be a straight street cop. Of course, those loyalties were challenged when I found that my government was guilty of drug smuggling, and that's when I made a decision which really has determined the course of my life from that day to this one.
And what was the reaction of the people you were working with at the time when you discovered this stuff?
Well, most people had no clue. This was not something that was widely known. This is not something you could walk down a hallway and talk about. But talking about CIA dealing drugs in 1977-78, I mean, a few people believed it. Now it's pretty much common knowledge. At the official level, where there was knowledge, it was that I was completely expendable, that I had opened my mouth about something that nobody talked about, and anyone who did try to talk about it was to be cut off.
So what was the next series of choices for you?
Well, the primary one was survival. I went through a number of years where even though I had no disciplinary actions, was not fired, was about to be promoted from LAPD, the LAPD and the CIA made sure that I was virtually unemployable. I was persecuted. I was arrested for selling liquor to a minor when the only job I could get was at a 7-Eleven store, even though I was a UCLA honors graduate. And so the first step was gaining credibility on an issue which didn't really happen until the end of 1979 when I came across some government documents and a news story that corroborated my own observations. But the real task for me early on was to figure out what was going on, and that was a process that essentially took about 15 years to understand that $600 billion a year now in drug money is laundered through U.S. financial institutions and the stock markets, the financial markets, which is an essential component to keeping the U.S. economy functioning. That money provides a great deal of power to those who control it, and those who don't control it have to work harder to get investment capital.
So I think the first time that your name became kind of a household word was when you had stood up in an L.A. forum mm-hmm. that John Deutsch was a part of. Can you tell us about that?
Well, the wonderful, talented journalist who just passed recently, Gary Webb, then with the San Jose Mercury News, had broken a series of stories in August of 1996 called The Dark Alliance, wherein he produced extremely hard documentary evidence of direct connections between the CIA during the Contra War, Contra supporters, and the smuggling of hundreds of tons of cocaine into the U.S., but most specifically into Los Angeles, where they were directed to a drug dealer known called Freeway Ricky Ross, and it caused a major national outcry across the country just a couple of months before the 96 presidential election. As a result of the national outrage, then CIA director, or DCI, Director of Central Intelligence, John Deutsch, came and actually, I think, foolishly made a public appearance at Locke High School in South Central Los Angeles to answer some of the critics. And I was at that meeting, and I stood up, and I directly confronted him as a former LAPD narcotics investigator with names of specific CIA operations. I made it very clear that I had documents to support what I was saying, and basically after that question was put forth, or that statement was made by me, John Deutsch literally lost his cool in public, and it's probably one of the most enjoyable moments of my life.
Were there any repercussions for what you'd done there?
Well, lots. The senior staff of both the Senate and the House Permanent Select Committees on Intelligence flew teams out to interview me in Los Angeles, copied many of my documents, promised a full investigation, and of course, over the course of a couple of years, basically nothing happened. Hearings that were promised to have been held in public were held in secret. The one blessing of this was as a result of activist pressure and community pressure, the CIA's Inspector General's office released a report, Volume 2 of the IG report in October of 1998, which literally confirmed that the CIA had been a direct hands-on participant in the drug trade, although the cover letters, which is all the New York Times had talked about, or the Washington Post, or Time or Newsweek, said that they had found no evidence. But that report was literally a godsend. It gave us absolute proof and confirmation that Gary Webb had been right, and that I and many other former law enforcement people who had talked about CIA and drugs had been telling the truth and dead-on accurate for a great many years.
And when did you begin your website, Cop v. CIA?
Well, actually, the website is fromthewilderness.com. We no longer use copvcia.com. That's a secondary site. Fromthewilderness.com, I began my newsletter in March of 1998 by mailing out 68 copies of an eight-page newsletter. And I said, look, if you guys like what we've done here, send us $25, we'll do it again next month. And here we are now almost 7 years later with in excess of 21,000 subscribers in 40 countries around the world. So the website went up sometime in the summer of 1998 and has been growing ever since.
And how big of an operation is that?
Oh, we have four full-time employees right now aside from me. And plus we have three editors and about four or five other writers that we deal with on a regular basis. So we've grown considerably, and we're just about to undergo a major expansion again as a result of the success of my book and very strong continuing interest in the kinds of stories we've been putting out at From the Wilderness.
And that leads us to your new book that has just come out, Crossing the Rubicon. Can you tell us what the motivation was in doing that?
Well, clearly for me and many other Americans, the so-called attacks, or the attacks of 9/11, were what was a watershed moment in American history and world history. I took the title from an event which took place in 49 B.C. when Julius Caesar took a Roman legion and crossed the boundary, the border of Rome, which was the river or creek, or really it's a large creek, the Rubicon, which is the boundary of Rome. And the constitution of the Roman Republic had forbade Roman legions from ever entering the country proper. from the moment that Julius Caesar entered Rome with a legion, the Roman Republic was dead and the Roman Empire had been born. In a literary sense, I think crossing a Rubicon means crossing a point of no return, a line, a moment in history where everything fundamentally changes, and it's not going back to the way it was. And so we looked at, and I and many other people have looked at 9/11 very closely, and in this book, which is 600 pages with 1,000 footnotes, I establish very clearly that the attacks of 9/11, and I have constructed it as a legal case. I'm a former detective, and I wrote the book as a legal brief, if you will, that a detective would take to a DA for prosecution. And my case says clearly, and most of the reviews, almost all the reviews, are very clear that I've made that case, that the attacks of 9/11 took place not only with the knowledge of the U.S. government and the blessings, but with direct hands-on coordination from Vice President Richard Cheney, who was running a completely separate command and control and communication system in the basement of the White House on the morning of 9/11. The clearest single piece of evidence, which has never been addressed, is why on the morning of September the 11th were a number of war games. Now we're up to four or five, and this is based on new information documented since the book came out, which effectively moved U.S. fighter response out of the region, limiting the number of fighters available to 8 to respond, and which also inserted false radar blips on the radar screens of the Northeast Air Defense Sector where all attacks took place, and actually also involved the flying of actual airplanes by the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Air Force, posing as hijacked airliners. The net result of that systematic and organized scheduling of war games was to completely paralyze air defense response on September the 11th, when we know from the Associated Press that 67 times in the calendar year prior to June 1, 2001, U.S. Air Force fighter aircraft had been scrambled and flying beside off-course aircraft within a matter of 10 minutes or so. Yet on 9/11, we had an hour and 40 minutes where we couldn't put a fighter anywhere near one of these hijacked airliners.
In your book, you go into great detail on a lot of this stuff. How did you come across the information that you've put forward there?
Well, the book itself is a long construct. It was important in telling this case to give the reader an understanding of how the world is really working, or how the world was really working economically, politically, militarily, and from an energy standpoint before, during, and after the attacks of 9/11. It's not just focused on that. That's why we call it the decline of the empire, because of this. The model we put out in Crossing the Rubicon is one that's intensely applicable to everything that is happening today as a result of 9/11. So I have built on a large number of research sources. I have a very strict research methodology. That's why I have 1,000 footnotes in the book, which I liken to exhibits that you present to a jury in a murder trial. And those are all presented for verification, and of course they've all held up since the book came out in September. So I have built over the years a large network of researchers, both inside government and out, but I also use mainstream press sources, government records and reports, statements before the so-called Independent 9/11 Commission. I have scoured literally the world for all of my sources, which are irrefutable. They can all be checked and verified.
Getting back to some of the specifics of the military simulations that were running on 9/11, could you tell us about a couple of those?
Well, we used NORAD records and initial records submitted to the King Commission, the 9/11 Commission. That 9/11 Commission report, which was unfortunately one of the best-selling political books of last year, is literally a pack of demonstrable lies, false information. The commission itself fabricated much of its data in the report to come up with a prepackaged conclusion. But we know of several war games, one of which is Vigilant Guardian, which is one of the key exercises, which we have documented using statements from NORAD officers, the U.S. Air Force, the Pentagon, so on and so forth, various government websites, was taking place in the Northeast Air Defense Sector. That's where all the attacks occurred, which apparently involved the injection or the insertion of false radar blips even on FAA air traffic control screens, so that when the first hijackings occurred, it was impossible for air traffic controllers to segregate or identify the hijacked airliners from the false radar blips. We had other exercises like Northern Vigilance, which had pulled a significant number, top secret number, but we know it was significant from statements of fighter aircraft out of the region and sent them to northern Canada and Alaska to participate in some fictitious Soviet over-the-pole Cold War bomber exercise. Other exercises like Northern Guardian had to move fighter aircraft to Iceland, and there are several others, all of which operated, if you will, as a complete package to effectively make sure that there were no fighters available, or very few fighters available, eight fighters. They have to fly in pairs to respond to as many as 22 possible hijackings, and they were all paralyzed because unless you know that you have a hijacking, you can't send your fighters possibly in the wrong direction.
It was interesting that after 9/11 that numerous White House representatives, for instance, Condoleezza Rice, would repeatedly say that they had never imagined the scenario using planes to crash into buildings. But as you point out in your book, the NRO had actually been conceiving just that that idea.
Well, no. There was a National Reconnaissance Office drill actually on the same day, but and I have interviewed NRO personnel and CIA personnel, which is closely affiliated with the National Reconnaissance Office. And that hijack was a simulated of a crash of an aircraft having a flame out on takeoff from Dulles Airport and crashing into the building, which is very close to the end of the runway. That was not a simulated hijack exercise or a terrorist weapon exercise. However, in crossing the Rubicon, we've documented at least 15 to 20 different instances where the U.S. government had run drills for terrorist hijacked airliners to be crashed into buildings, where they had run live fly exercises about it. We're going back to as far back as 1997 when they captured computer records about Project Bojinka in the Philippines, which was connected to Al-Qaeda, that the government was extremely aware that this was a preferred method of attack for hijackers. Condoleezza Rice was clearly and absolutely lying when she made such a statement.
What is your response to when people say that the U.S. government complicity in 9/11 couldn't possibly happen, there'd just be too many people involved, and that somebody would be coming forward and saying that something had happened?
Well, I go to great pains to that right up in the front of the book. That is a standard shibboleth argument used to shut down effective debate. It is not true. Anyone with experience with covert operations, I'm one of them, I've studied them for 20-plus years. I've met and dealt with a great number of covert operations personnel from the CIA, the military, and many others. You don't need tens of thousands of people or thousands of people to know about such a plan, especially when you're using what's called compartmentalized intelligence. We kept the Manhattan Project a secret. We kept the stealth fighter program, by and large, a secret. And that's because a person building, let's say, making an epoxy resin for the F-117 stealth fighter would have no knowledge of what the end product was intended to do or what it was for. The same thing was true with the Manhattan Project and the atom bomb. A guy enriching uranium-238 or 235 would have no idea necessarily that it might be used to build a bomb or what the bomb would look like. That's one of the weakest arguments, and it's one of the most easy to dispel.
Assuming that members in our government were complicit in this, what would they have to gain?
Well, the primary motive for the attacks of 9/11 and for everything that has happened since. We are living in what Dick Cheney told us on September 12th or 13th of 2001 is infinite war, state of infinite war, war which will, quote, not end in our lifetimes. The plain and simple fact, extremely well documented all in Crossing the Rubicon and on our website From the Wilderness Now by a variety and a multitude of major press sources from the BBC to CNN to ABC, is the fact that the world is at or near what is called peak oil production. All oil production follows a bell curve. We've used literally half of all the oil that the universe ever made for us on this planet in about 110 years or so. Once you reach the peak of oil production, nothing under any circumstances that can be done will ever increase oil production again. You can throw all the money at it, all the technology at it you want. It's irreversible, scientifically proven. We have also plucked all of the low-hanging fruit. In other words, we have used and exploited, identified all of the largest pools of the light sweet crude oil. Now we have to go to drill and or find smaller deposits of more expensive oil that's harder to get to, deeper, it's offshore, to try to meet a demand that is still increasing exponentially. And there are 10 calories of hydrocarbon energy, especially oil and natural gas, in every calorie of food consumed on this planet. The world population went from roughly 2 billion at the turn of the last century to 6.5 billion now, and that's all made possible by hydrocarbon energy. That energy, as we document in the book, Dick Cheney has known it, Halliburton's known it, the governments have known it for a long time, is about to go into irreversible decline. So what we are witnessing now is a sequential war to control the last large remaining oil reserves on the planet, and there's no more oil going to be found. Oil discoveries have been in steady and progressive decline since 1964, and for 2 years now, almost, we have had not a single discovery of a field of 500 million barrels of oil or greater, a so-called mega field. And to put that in context, the planet uses a billion barrels of oil about every 11 days now. In other words, we haven't found one oil field to give us a five-day supply of oil in the last 2 years.
It's amazing the number of products that we interact with on our everyday lives that require oil for their production as well as their delivery.
Everything from food to plastics. 70% of all transportation is oil-powered. You take the oil away, that goes. There are no alternative energy sources which will replace hydrocarbon energy. And we literally live in a society, well, Colin Campbell, one of the foremost oil geologists and exploration scientists and a peak oil spokesman in the world, says very clearly we are a subspecies of Homo sapiens called petroleum man. And clearly, with very shortly, probably by 2007, 2008, we will see the first very, very hard major shortfalls in oil production ability. And that leads Campbell and many others, PhDs all, to conclude that the subspecies of petroleum man is about to become extinct. That doesn't mean the human race will become extinct, but there will be an associated reduction in population and most certainly in consumption.
What's your take, then, on why Americans are so disconnected from digging up facts on 9/11 as well as the peak oil problem?
Well, in a word, denial. This is not something also that's unique in human history, nor is it anything that's really surprising from a psychological standpoint. But again, I must clearly state that I do not believe the mainstream media's position that there are only a few people who are asking these questions and that we're all mentally unbalanced. That's not the case. My experience, I've lectured on 9/11 in 8 countries now. We've sold 20,000 copies of my DVD, The Truth and Lies of 9/11. I've lectured at 9 major universities in the United States, about to add 3 more to that list in the first 3 months of this year. So there are many people who have questions about 9/11. But again, people don't want to face issues that are extremely psychologically challenging or emotionally challenging. That's a common human trait. It's also one that's, of course, really not adaptive. As opposed to the U.S. and having lectured in all these other countries, I can tell you that most of the rest of the world absolutely doesn't believe the U.S. government position about 9/11, and it's perfectly transparent to them. So it's a matter of psychological choice. Either you can deal with the truth, or you can live in a fantasy world. And of course, we know which way is more adaptive or more conducive to survival.
And you believe the fantasy world that Americans are dealing with in large part is due to the corporate-owned media?
Well, the corporate-owned media, and I go to great lengths at the beginning of the book to lay out an economic paradigm which really incentivizes not truth-telling. And to blame the media is wrong, because the media, in a sense, is a victim of an economic paradigm which imprisons us all. The major media trades their stock on Wall Street. All corporations trading on Wall Street are in one way or another dependent upon, among other things, a cheap energy subsidized by the U.S. military's enforcement of the dollar, which is coming under serious challenge as the currency of the world reserve currency. But the fact that Wall Street is dependent upon $600 billion a year in drug money moving through it, and there's a very close connection between oil and drugs as it relates to 9/11, specifically with regard to Afghanistan, where the CIA has overseen, according to CNN, something like a 250% increase in the amount of opium grown in Afghanistan since we occupied the country. The media is part of the conditioning. But as I say very clearly in Crossing the Rubicon, until we change the way money works, we are not going to successfully change anything.
Was it tough finding a publisher for your book, Crossing the Rubicon?
Well, we had spoken to a great number of publishers. There was some strong interest, but there were few of great courage. And finally, my agent, Ken Levine, was able to connect with New Society Publishers in Canada, who put forth the book. Now, of course, the publishing industry behaves the way anybody else does, with a herd mentality. Now that the book has been has done very well. Our first printing has sold out. Our second printing is now available. Amazon.com, as reported on C-SPAN, named the book as one of the 5 best-selling political books of 2004. That's on our website. It's been named Book of the Year by the Online Review of Books. So, and having seen that, many of the publishing companies are now knocking on our door asking if we can get out of our contract. And we're just moving ahead with the book as we have it now. But there was clearly a market for this. There were clearly a lot of people who had fundamental questions about, basically centered around the fact that they could look at the world around them and say that it didn't make sense what they were being told about everything. And that's especially true as we have 1,300 combat deaths in Iraq. That number, of course, is going to increase as the economy is failing, as we've been progressively and increasingly lied to by a government. Both presidential elections have left a lot of people with questions. And what they wanted and what they needed was a good map of how the world really works. And that's what I attempted to do in Crossing the Rubicon, was to give people a map that they could trust about how things work and why they work that way, so that they could incorporate future events and analyze them according to that map, so that they would have a better understanding of what's really driving, literally, I think, the human race to a point of where it may actually destroy itself and the planet.
Have you experienced any negative repercussions since the book's publication?
Not really. I mean, I have 24 years, 25 years of negative repercussions before the book was published. What we have encountered really from any official source is silence, which is a tactic taken quite frequently by the mainstream media and the government when they cannot refute the arguments that are exposing their wrongdoing, and they cannot attack the character or the personality of the person involved. I've survived all of that for a long time. So basically, all we get now from the mainstream sources is just complete silence.
So you are going to be speaking in Seattle on Saturday the 15th. What can people expect at your talk?
Well, we will spend part of the time talking about the material in Crossing the Rubicon. However, it's become clear to us at FTW and in our subscriber base that we have a whole host of serious impending crises and developments behind peak oil, which is really starting to hit home around the world, and behind a pending major U.S. economic collapse, which I'm certain will take place, as are many other experts. We've quoted a number of them in our last economic alert. I mean, like Stephen Roach of Morgan Stanley, members of the Federal Reserve, Treasury Secretary, people around the world, that this major crash is coming, and we have to look ahead. We have to spend not too much time focusing on what's happened in the past. I, for one, believe that the U.S. electoral process is dead. If we didn't overturn the 2000 election, there's certainly no reason to waste time on the 2004 election. So we have to focus and prepare for the major, major challenges that are certain to hit us in the next year, the next 2, 3, 4 years. As I've said very clearly, we know now, mathematically, it is done, because it takes X number of years to bring an oil field online, because we know what discoveries are, that mathematically by 2007, 2008, we will see progressive blackouts in the industrialized nations, some of which, according to Richard Duncan, a major oil geologist and scientist centered in Oregon, will become permanent, start to become permanent by 2008. This is the biggest challenge ever presented to the human race as a whole. FTW's focus is now shifting on making our subscribers and those who read us better informed, and giving them more information to help them survive and adjust to these major challenges, which are just about to hit us like a locomotive at full speed.
And for those that won't be able to make your talk, how can they find out more about your work?
You can visit our website at www.fromthewilderness.com. For those who would like to order the book or any of our DVDs, we do have a toll-free order line, which is 866-222-7693.
All right. Well, Mike Rupert, I want to thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Thank you. I'm very much looking forward to being up in Seattle. I love it up there.